37th Malinowski Lecture. The Malinowski Lecture, as I'm sure you all know, commemorates Bronislaw Malinowski, the first professor of anthropology in the LSE and the founder of our department, but more importantly, of course, the founder of modern social anthropology. Unlike many honorary lectureships, the Malinowski Lectureship is awarded to somebody who's closer to the start of their career than the end, somebody who's already achieved much, but whom we can confidently expect to achieve a great deal more in the future. And tonight's lecturer, Charles Stewart from the University College, admirably fits these criteria. Charles was born and brought up in the United States and took his first degree at Brandeis University. He then came to Oxford, where he completed his DPhil in 1987 on the basis of research in Naxos in Greece, where he combined his prodigious linguistic abilities with the training he'd received as an anthropologist in Oxford. After Oxford, he returned to Harvard, where he was a lecturer in modern Greek for 3 years, and then he came to Brunel University in 1991, and in 1993, he moved to University College, where he's now a lecturer in anthropology. In 1991, Princeton University Press published Demons and the Devil, Moral Imagination in Modern Greek Culture, which was based on his research. And since then, he has repeatedly returned to Greece to carry out more research. With Rosalind Shaw, he was the editor of a book on syncretism and anti-syncretism, and he's also published numerous papers. Tonight's lecture has the intriguing title, All Over the LSE, people have been saying, how do you get people with titles like this? And Lord Desai told me this afternoon that if any economist had attempted to produce a title like this, he'd never have been allowed to give the lecture. How lucky we are. Anyway, tonight's title is Erotic Dreams and Nightmares from Antiquity to the Present. Charles Stewart.
Thank you. Thank you very much to Professor Fuller for that most generous introduction, and to the Anthropology Department of the LSE for inviting me to give this lecture. It's a very great honor to deliver this year's Malinowski lecture. I'm indebted to a great number of people in my career, and I can't mention them all right now, but I'd like to thank just three people. First of all, Adam Cooper, who took the risk of appointing me to my first full-time anthropology job. And without him, literally, I wouldn't be here right now. And secondly, if I take a longer time frame, I'd like to thank my two doctoral supervisors. I was very lucky to have both John Campbell and Margaret Alexiou as supervisors. And they've been a constant and very great inspiration to me over 17 years now. Right, Erotic Dreams and Nightmares from Antiquity to the Present. For this lecture, I actually have an epigraph. It's from Karl Marx, and I think it will be known to every good student at the London School of Economics. Men make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves, but under circumstances directly encountered, given and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all the dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brain of the living. This quote from Marx introduces two of my main interests. First, the idea of the nightmare. Second, the nature of continuity in history. See if I can restore the lights. Must be a specter haunting the room. For Marx, history is like a nightmare. For me, the nightmare has a history. And I intend to use this oppressive history as a vehicle to explore the transmission of tradition. Prepare yourselves, then, for the nightmarish history of the nightmare. Numerous studies, I'd just like to contextualize where this paper is coming from. Numerous studies have appeared recently discussing early Christian and medieval conceptions of erotic dreams, nocturnal emissions, and the dangers they posed to monks, clergy, and the Christian laity. And since Michel Foucault's History of Sexuality, scholars of ancient Greece have paid increasing attention to erotic dreams and the codes for interpreting them. But there have been almost no studies of the nightmare in antiquity, save for two works from early this century. The German classicist Wilhelm Roscher traced the nightmare from ancient Greece to the Renaissance in a turn-of-the-century work called Ephialtes. And the other work is Ernest Jones's On the Nightmare, the core of which was originally published as two articles around 1910, but which did not appear as a book until 1931. Both Roscher and Jones take for granted the connection between erotic dreams and nightmares in classical antiquity, although for very different reasons. As we shall see, erotic dreams and nightmares were conjoined in the Middle Ages with lingering effects into the present. Roscher was taken in by the conceptualization of nightmares that shaped his own times and which he assumed also prevailed in the pre-Christian period. Jones also surmised that an erotic dream-nightmare complex held in antiquity. Taking a psychoanalytical view, he contended that human beings everywhere felt tremendous guilt about erotic dreams because these were, in fact, expressions of the Oedipal wish to have intercourse with one's parents. This thought was so disturbing that it needed to be thoroughly repressed, and sensations of horror, fear, and asphyxiation served to blot out the real feelings of desire that had given rise to the dream. Jones postulated a continuum from exclusively erotic dreams at one end of the pole, at one pole, to the other extreme where there was only terror and no erotic component whatever. In his view, all erotic dreams were incipient nightmares. Indeed, since the last century, erotic dreams have often been categorized in the psychological literature as a subset of the nightmare. And it was while teaching a course at University College London on dreams that I was first alerted by one of my students to the interest in the erotic dream-nightmare connection. It happened when one of my students objected to this classification of erotic dreams as nightmares. "My own erotic dreams are anything but nightmares," she declared. And one of the main objectives of this lecture is to understand how this conflation occurred historically. The psychoanalytic interpretation is unsatisfactory for other reasons than the phenomenological one that struck my student. For one thing, it is difficult to comprehend why dreaming of sex with, say, an attractive stranger might necessarily relate to a latent incest wish. Even granted this assumption, one may wonder how any sexual content could ever make it into the manifest dimension of dreams, as it would be too undisguised and too disturbing to consciousness to get past the dream sensor, unless it were actually the expression of a latent content having little to do with sexuality. The difficulty posed by the need to assume that dreams are always the expression of a latent unconscious wish, one that is probably sexual in nature and often stems from the Oedipus complex, makes the Freudian position on repression difficult to accept wholly, although some aspects of this model still possess a good deal of analytical power. Of course, Malinowski already fought the battle over the universality of the Oedipus complex against the very same Ernest Jones who wrote On the Nightmare. His Sex and Repression in Savage Society is a direct response to Jones's criticisms of his identification of a matrilineal complex, whereby in the Trobriand Islands. Jones accused Malinowski of misunderstanding psychoanalysis altogether. If he had absorbed the first lesson, he would know that the Oedipus complex is invariant and universal, and thus it must underlie the Trobriand complex that Malinowski had identified. Many people assume that Malinowski had little sympathy for psychoanalysis, but he was actually attempting to engage with a number of psychoanalytic suppositions. Malinowski certainly embraced the idea of repression, and he attempted to use it as a means of demonstrating the reality of the Trobriand complex. The ideas central to such a complex, such as having sex with one's sister, would be the most highly repressed in Trobriand society. So if he could show, for example, that a dream of incest with one's sister was more disturbing and embarrassing than a dream of sex with one's mother, then this indicated that a matrilineal complex was in place, and not an Oedipal one. In my view, if there was an aspect of psychoanalysis that Malinowski misunderstood, then surely this was repression. According to Freud's complicated and often revised view, repressed ideas were such because they could not be admitted into consciousness except in distorted forms that the conscious mind could not readily decipher. Decipherment was the job of qualified psychoanalysts. For Malinowski, brother-sister incest would receive direct, although rare, highly charged, and acutely embarrassing expression in dreams, folklore, or crimes of passion. That were crimes of passion were crimes for the circular reason that they should have stayed repressed but didn't. If repression worked in the way Freud supposed, then Malinowski would never have been able to collect the myths, folktales, and erotic dreams that he did. They would not have existed, nor for that matter would much of the material that I will soon examine. So repression, in the Freudian sense, does not appear to be the issue. Rather than repressing ideas and images unconsciously, it seems to be the case that Trobrianders, as well as early Christians, and many others, including ourselves, often do so intentionally and in full consciousness. This does not necessarily render the effects of this process weak or irrelevant. Repressed material can still be charged and return with frightening consequences. But it does mean that we are dealing with domains that are much more amenable to anthropological and historical analysis than the unconscious. I will maintain here that erotic dreams have more to do with active self-making, with the formulation and exploration of subjectivity, than with an unconscious informed by a phylogenetically inherited Oedipus complex attended by feelings of guilt. This Freudian supposition differs little from the Christian notion of ancestral sin and deserves to be considered as a similar historically and culturally relative formulation rather than as a universal analytical principle. I move now to erotic dreams and nightmares. Malinowski's diaries, covering two separate field research trips in 1914 and in 1917, provide one particularly good example of how programmatic self-making, fantasy, and dreaming all interact and inform each other and articulate with cultural assumptions. In these pages, he remembers his life in Europe and Australia, and he imagines his future career, including his eventual entry in Who's Who. He also repeatedly excoriates himself for reading too many novels or entertaining thoughts that he himself variously terms impure, lecherous, sensual, or erotic. In addition to all this, he mentions more than 20 of his own dreams, at least five of which have erotic content and show a continuity with his daytime thinking. For his diary entry of 8 June 1918, he wrote, "This morning, I awoke early. I did not sleep very well and had two horrid dreams. In the first one, which was of a Freudian type, feeling of sinfulness, evil, something loathsome combined with lust, repulsive and frightening. What does it come from? And this feeling of wickedness which rises to the surface." Could this be an erotic nightmare? At this point, perhaps it's necessary to clarify what may qualify as either an erotic dream or a nightmare before we begin to analyze their combination. The word nightmare can be used to describe any unpleasant or terrifying dream that disturbs sleep or causes distress. The word has been extended metaphorically to refer to any unpleasant event, but I will use it only in connection with dream experiences. In the ancient historical sections of this paper, in fact, I begin with a much more restricted sense of nightmare, namely dream visions where the sleeper feels a weight on his or her chest and has accompanying sensations of dyspnea, difficult breathing, paralysis, and dread. Sufferers frequently state that a person, an animal, or a demonic being causes these feelings by perching on or jumping up and down on their chest. And here you can see a well-known representation, Fuseli's Nightmare, first exhibited in 1782 at the Royal Academy in London. There are grounds for calling this the classic nightmare because the concept of demonic pressure was salient in classical antiquity, and it is an image that informs the current vocabulary for the phenomenon in a number of European languages. As you can see from the epigraph, the word for the nightmare in Marx's epigraph was Alp. Was Alp. It literally means an elf. And the word for nightmare in German was Alptraum, or Alpdruck, which literally means elf pressure. And so through other European languages, the part of Koshmar, Mar, comes from a water demon, a water monster, a vampire. Our very word nightmare is related to Anglo-Saxon Mara, a crusher. And there you can see the vocabulary for modern Greek, a demon that jumps on sleepers, and you're supposed to grab her cap to control her. One thing, however, our word nightmare is not related to the word for mare, female horse, although Fuseli's depiction of the horse in the bedroom has sometimes caused some confusion on that matter. Numerous distinctions also need to be made in respect to the concept of erotic dream. I'll put it back on Fuseli, maybe more interesting. Not every dream of sex may be classified as an erotic dream. The criterion of erotic requires that the dreamer feel sexually stimulated. This is often difficult to know with respect to historical dreams. Take, for example, some of the oldest sex dreams we know, recorded in an Egyptian papyrus that might date back as far as 2000 BC. If a man saw his penis becoming large, this meant his possessions would multiply. If copulating with his mother, this was good because his clansmen would cleave to him. If copulating with his sister, this was also good, foretelling the bequeathing of something to him. On the other hand, if he saw himself copulating with a pig, this was bad and meant he would be deprived of his possessions. And if he saw himself copulating with his wife in daylight, this was also a bad omen and meant the seeing of his misdeeds by his god. What is clear is that the ancient Egyptians had a binary system of interpretation. Signs were either good or bad. This is a characteristic of the dream key approach. Dreams are not analyzed as narratives, but are, rather, rated for particular symbols which inform people about important life issues, such as whether they will be economically or politically successful. As Foucault has contended, sex and sexuality did not have the same powerful significance that they have today. Sex acts in dreams were often just symbols for expressing more important, perhaps we might even say latent, issues to do with wealth and social status. The situation reverses Freud's suppositions. Reports of dreams from contexts other than dream books seem similarly unerotic. Consider, for example, the following inscription from the healing shrine at Epidaurus, recorded in the 4th century BC to memorialize a dream had by a female pilgrim from Messene. Sleeping here, she saw a dream. It seemed to her the god came, bringing a snake creeping beside him, and she had sex with it. And from this, children were born to her, within a year, twin boys. Is the sex here erotic? Maybe it was more of a nightmare. We may also compare a similar dream from Epidaurus where a woman sees a snake lie on her stomach, after which she bears 5 children. No sex is mentioned, and the signs of the nightmare are there. Certainly both of these dreams were religious experiences that we would today term miraculous, and the sex is a means of contact with the god. Ultimately, in the absence of a dreamer's comment that a particular dream was sexually arousing, we cannot be certain that every dream of sex was erotic. I turn now to more ancient evidence. The organs of thought and feeling were multiple in Greek thought, early Greek thought. Although distributed among the chest, the liver, the heart, as well as in the head, they were all situated within the body. The gods could intervene and influence people's thoughts and feelings, just as they could transmit true or false dreams to them. The soul of the person constituted their life force, and this departed only at death. It was not thought to travel out and receive dreams. Dreams were largely understood as prophetic in Homer, the messages sent by gods and seen while asleep. From Homeric times up until the present day, the way to say, I had a dream, in the Greek language, is literally, I saw a dream. In the classical period, opinions about the god-sent nature and predictive value of dreams began to divide, as can be seen in Herodotus's account of a dream which repeatedly came to the Persian ruler Xerxes. This dream urged him to wage war against the Greeks, even though he had resolved not to wage the war. His advisor, Artabanus, tells him not to pay attention to the dream. Dreams, he says, are just things that you have seen during the day and which float before your eyes at night. There's no need to take them seriously. A century later, the divine source of dreams would again be criticized, this time by Aristotle. He argued that dreams were similar to fantasy. They were mental pictures generated internally, not the messages of gods. The mental and physical condition of the sleeper were bound to have the greatest effect on dreams, and Aristotle conceded that dreams could be put to prognostic use in treating illness, but were not otherwise prophetic. The Hippocratic texts and later medical writers also included sections on how to interpret dreams in terms of body functions and humors. Rivers, for example, symbolize the circulatory system, a turbulent ocean, a stomach disorder, and so forth. There is plenty of evidence for erotic dreams in Greek antiquity, and the presence of this much positive testimony begins to make the case against a strong nightmare-erotic dream connection. The erotic dream was apparently so easy, it was easy enough, so easy to contemplate on its own. This Greek marble relief of an erotic dream dating to the 2nd century AD is striking for its openness. A sleeping shepherd, his staff and bagpipe cast down by his side, is straddled by a winged figure. And by the way, winged figures were the symbol of the dream or the content of the dream in classical Greek iconography. That dreams were often expressions of desires or even of something approaching instinct was not an alien idea to the ancient Greeks. Plato articulated it clearly at the beginning of Book 9 of the Republic, where he considered the need to control unruly desires, especially those aroused in sleep, when the soul, the rational part of the person, rests. The savage part of the person, if sated with food and wine, would not at this point stop from anything once it is released from all shame and reason. Note the physical preconditions for the nightmare, similar to Aristotle, who came later. It would not, he says, shrink from attempting to lie with a mother, another man, a god, or a beast. On the other hand, if a man is moderate and self-controlled in waking life, then even in sleep he will have reasonable dreams. Freud cites this passage from Plato in his interpretation of dreams, but the ancient Greeks did not conform very well to his theory. For Freud, the most unthinkable dream was the Oedipal dream. For Jones, this was what prompted nightmares in the first place. It was a dream that couldn't or shouldn't be dreamt, the impossible psychoanalytic dream. And yet the Greeks apparently dreamt it time and time again. This much is acknowledged right in Sophocles' play, when Oedipus confides to Jocasta that he had a dream that he slept with his mother. She counsels him not to worry, because many people see such dreams, and it is best to pay no heed to them. Not only do such dreams occur in Greek sources, but they frequently receive good interpretations. Hippias, a Greek serving as the Persian's guide in the landing at Marathon, sees a dream of himself sleeping with his mother and interprets this to mean that he will return to Athens and recover power. Artemidorus is filled with interpretations of dreams of sex with one's mother in every conceivable position. It was a good dream for politicians, for instance, because the mother represented one's native country, and to make love is to govern the obedient and willing partner of one's body. The dreamer would thus control the affairs of the city. So much for erotic dreams. What about nightmares? Our best evidence for the existence of the nightmare is the etymology of the name Ephialtes itself, the personification of the nightmare first introduced in the Odyssey. Etymologically, it seems to mean to jump on top of. Later, another name for the nightmare, Pnigalion, the strangler or the throttler, was coined in the 1st century BC. That's about all we have to go on. But did it also have an erotic component, as Roscher assumed? One of the main reasons that people think there must have been a link is the identification between the god Pan and Ephialtes. Pan, the goat-footed nature god, was indeed bound up with sexuality, probably the best evidence of which comes from vase paintings rather than ancient texts. There is, however, no early evidence of erotic Pan nightmares. The exhaustive study of the cult of Pan by Philippe Bourgeaud does not mention any. The first connection of Pan with Ephialtes does not come until late in the first century BC. But nothing is said about whether these Pan nightmares are also erotic nightmares until Artemidorus in the second century AD. Artemidorus writes, and I quote, "Ephialtes is identified with Pan, but he has a different meaning. If he oppresses or weighs a man down without speaking, it signifies tribulations and distress. But whatever he says upon interrogation is true. If he gives someone something or has sexual intercourse with someone, it foretells great profit, especially if he does not weigh that person down." Here at last we have all the components of the erotic nightmare present. But note that we're also well into the Roman imperial period. Roscher wasn't able to add much more to this evidence, only two further later classical texts. This then is the evidence for the erotic nightmare in antiquity. We wouldn't necessarily expect that such nightmares would have been systematically recorded, but this is really very little. The Artemidorus quote may well be the tip of a large iceberg extending back into antiquity, or then again, there may have been nothing else there. In my view, a crucial development in the forging of the erotic dream nightmare connection came with the coinage of the Latin word incubus around the beginning of the Common Era. The term succubus was coined much later to refer to sexual nightmare demons that lay beneath the sleeper. The sexual connotations of incubus are unmistakable. It's related to other Latin words for having sex, cubitare, concumbere, concubinus, whence we get our word concubine, to name just a few. The first meaning of the word incubus was simply nightmare, and it may have been an intentional translation of the Greek ephialtes, but the sexual connotations of the word incubus would, in the future, from that point on, help to weld the nightmare to the erotic dream. The availability of erotic overtones in the word incubus would have profound effects on medieval Christian conceptions of erotic dreams and nightmares. Before considering the Christian period, I would like to return to the philosophical and medical conceptions of erotic dreams as these had been developed up to the first centuries AD. In the classical period, as we saw, there were two competing views of dreams. They were either prophetic or natural, the products of the body. Artemidorus, a professional dream interpreter in Asia Minor during the Roman Empire, as we've seen, also observed this distinction between prophetic and mainly physical dreams. Although Artemidorus' system actually distinguished five types of dreams overall, two kinds of physical dreams and three kinds of prophetic dream. Erotic dreams and nocturnal emissions belonged to one of his physical categories of dream. The learned traditions of medicine and philosophy mainly settled on a threefold classification of dreams. I ask you to consider the following slightly complicated passage from the 3rd century BC medical writer Herophilus, but preserved in a later author. Herophilus says that some dreams are inspired by a god and arise by necessity, while others are natural ones and arise when the soul forms for itself an image, eidolon, of what is to its own advantage and of what will happen next. And still others are mixed and arise spontaneously according to the impact of the images, whenever we see what we wish, as happens in the case of those who, in their sleep, make love to the women they love. Similar tripartite classifications of dreams along very similar lines were held by the Stoics of the first centuries BC and by Philo of Alexandria, among others. The interesting part of this scheme is the third, or mixed category, which closely corresponded to the phantasma, the phantasm, in later Greek terminology. Outside forces, images, impinge on the sleeper, but also coincide with what the sleeper inwardly desires. Questions arose already in antiquity over the nature of the external forces. Epicurean dream theory drew on optical theory in general, which held that eidola were film-like images that constantly flowed from all solid bodies and which penetrated or even opened pores or pathways of viewers or of sleepers. And in other words, there were constant rays projecting out from the solid environment. And these rays, in fact, penetrated dreamers, so that it provoked dreams in them even while they were asleep. They were perceiving even while asleep. What is interesting for my purposes, is that this tripartite scheme was taken over by Christian writers, who then treated the mixed dream as demonic and ultimately as diabolical. Examples would be Tertullian, who classed dreams as either from the devil, from God, or from the soul, and Prudentius, who only substituted Christ for God, dreams from the devil, from Christ, or from the soul. Herophilus's example of the erotic dream to characterize mixed dreams is not in the least fortuitous. For the early Christian writers, this would become the demonic dream par excellence. We need to take a quick look at medical theories on the eve of Christianity to add one more dimension to our understanding of erotic dreams. Ancient medical opinion held that both men and women could have orgasmic dreams. Aristotle supposed humans to be unique among all animals in this respect. Was it, he wondered, because they slept on their backs, or because of their special capacity for fantasy? There's no indication that people worried about these dreams on moral grounds, but medical writers like Soranus classified them as a type of gonorrhea, a term which literally means a flow of seed. Our terminology today still contains the assumption that this venereal disease is a kind of orgasmic dream which occurred without any pleasure. Soranus also saw wet dreams as the result of the influence of unreal images, called phantasia, fantasy by the Greeks, during sleep. And he wrote that it affects patients during sleep because of their desire for sexual pleasure. This could be a constant and uninterrupted desire, or the opposite. It could be the product of a long interruption of sexual practice, that is, of continence. But it can, quite often, turn into an illness, and at the same time be the announcement of another illness, like epilepsy. In the context of a generalized Greek ideology of moderation, the involuntary loss of seed could pose a problem. And by the way, Soranus thought that women suffered as well from this problem, just as much as men. His chapter on gonorrhea is to be found in his book on gynecology. The sexual act was compared with epilepsy because of the involuntary spasms involved. Trends of thought at this time, such as Stoicism, emphasized the need for the person to maintain control over their desires, and gonorrhea, or nocturnal emissions, were worrisome because of the passive, involuntary submission to fantasy. Continence, the ultimate expression of control, received consideration and validation at this time. Thus we can see that even before widespread conversion to Christianity, control of bodily desires and impulses had arisen as an issue, and erotic dreams were one of the battle lines. A sign of spiritual progress and strength of the soul would be the ability to resist or never incur the bombardment of images that could cause erotic dreams. I move now to consider the Christian period. The death of the great god Pan, reported by Plutarch, was converted into a subject for Christian homily by Eusebius and probably other early Christian bishops as well. Interesting that his disappearance from nature should be balanced by increased numbers of encounters with his destabilizing erotic power in dreams. It was not just Pan, but all of the pagan gods who were assimilated to demons, controlled by the devil in the early Christian view. Granted the possibly satanic origin of dreams, they needed to be distrusted. John Climacus, an early 7th century writer whose Ladder of Divine Ascent was something of a handbook for monks, wrote the following passage about devils who take on the appearance of angels of light, and this is a 14th century manuscript illumination of this very passage that I'm about to read from Climacus's text. Devils often take on the appearance of angels of light or martyrs, and they appear to us in sleep and talk to us. And if we start to believe in the devils of our dreams, then we will be their playthings when we are also awake. The man who believes in dreams shows his inexperience, while the man who distrusts every dream is very sensible. Trust only the dreams that foretell torments and judgment for you. But even these dreams may be from demons if they produce despair in you. And I have one other slide I wanted to show from Climacus. This is from an 11th century manuscript illumination, and it's an illustration of a passage out of Climacus's text. In the passages, he who believes in dreams is like a person running after his own shadow. That's represented there. This approach to dreams fitted within the context of monasticism and the hierarchy stretching from novices to spiritually advanced adepts to whom monks would confess impure dreams. The erotic dream obviously posed a serious problem in monasteries and among clerics generally. John Cassian, an early monastic writer, held that there were six steps on the way to spiritual purity. First, the monk does not give in to the assaults of the flesh while awake. Second, his spirit does not entertain erotic thoughts. Third, the sight of women stirs no response, on down to the sixth step where, quote, the seduction of feminine phantoms caused no illusions, even in sleep. This would be an indication of cupidity still located in the marrow. Cassian goes on to add that one sees at night what one lives during the day, and that a pure spiritual life will free one from impure dreams. The issue of whether a spirit could celebrate a priest could celebrate communion after a nocturnal emission, for example, was openly discussed by thinkers such as St. Augustine and Pope Gregory. These deliberations very much continued the discussion of key issues raised in Herophilus's category of the mixed dream, namely the nature and power of images and their relation to bodily responses. This is a subject that has been brilliantly addressed recently by the medievalist Diane Elliott. Augustine was inclined to think that nocturnal emissions were not the fault of the dreamer, and thus did not particularly pollute him. As he put it, if I have a nocturnal emission, I was not responsible for the act, although I'm sorry that by some means or other it happened to me. Cassian seems to write off nocturnal emissions if they can be blamed on a full stomach, as if this were a simple physical response in no way mediated or validated by the will. And Gregory, cited by Bede, gives us the most analytic presentation of the matter, distinguishing three types of nocturnal emission. Those involving natural superfluity or weakness are guiltless. Second, those resulting from superfluity brought on by gluttony bring taint, but do not bar participation in communion. And finally, those resulting from evil waking thoughts are sinful because they involve suggestion, pleasure, and consent, the serpent, Eve, and Adam. It is the consent of the spirit that completes the sin. I think here we can see a Christian theory of the mixed dream and the relation between the effect of images and bodily stimulation. Herophilus had defined the two forces in the mixed dream: external images and internal desires. Now the Christian writers sought to interpose a moment of delay, a rational consideration between the two. What were medical and epistemological questions for ancient philosophers and doctors became moral questions for the Church Fathers. This much we know about monks and the clergy. What about ordinary people? It's unlikely that they lived and felt these Christian ideals as intensely as illiterate monks and clerics, who are so disproportionately represented in the historical record. Obviously, people in the world continued to have sexual relations, dreams, erotic dreams, and nightmares. The Church could never regulate these phenomena, although it did try. Early penitential books, such as the Irish Penitential of Cumaen, composed in the 7th century after the model of Cassian's Rules for Monks, presents one such effort. We know that in subsequent centuries it circulated on the continent. This penitential is notable for its comprehensive distinctions among erotic deeds and thoughts. He who merely desires in his mind to commit fornication but is not able shall do penance for 1 year. He who is willingly polluted during sleep shall rise and sing 9 psalms in order, kneeling. He who desires to sin during sleep or is unintentionally polluted, 15 psalms. But he who sins but is not polluted, 24. Consider also the well-known Ambrosian prayer, initially for monastic recitation, before going to sleep. Let dreams and fantasies of the enemy recede far away and suppress our enemy, lest we pollute our bodies. This formula and other similar prayers may easily have passed beyond the walls of the monasteries to influence the formulas of daytime and especially bedtime prayers of the Christian laity. According to the French medievalist Le Goff, quote, the repression of dreams and the repression of sexuality were the work of the church, and we are not yet entirely liberated from its consequences. The more neurotic forms of Christianity created a nightmarish world in which not even darkness brought repose. The stories of witches' sabbaths, including sexual relations with the devil that circulated in the Middle Ages and Renaissance, mark the next phase of development. Church authorities in this period accused men and women of attending witches' sabbaths at which they might have sex with the devil or one of his familiars. The witch hunting manuals developed an elaborate picture of incubi, which affected women, and succubi, which copulated with men. According to the Malleus Maleficarum, such episodes occurred much more frequently among women, since they were more feeble, credulous, and less self-controlled than men. And I was astounded as I was doing the research for this paper a couple of years ago that Reebok announced that they were going to market a women's athletic training shoe called the Incubus. They quickly withdrew the idea. There was also speculation over whether succubi collected human sperm and then metamorphosed into incubi and inseminated mortal women to create hybrid demonic offspring. Much has been written about European witchcraft, but not enough attention is paid to the fact that many of the stories concerning details of sexual and other contact with the witches were often said to have occurred in dreams or fantasies. The 10th century Canon Episcopi, for example, a fundamental church text that served as a basis for the formulation of ideas about the witches' activities in the following centuries, says that these stories are, quote, the illusions and phantasms of demons. Although admittedly, the canon did accept the reality, the real existence of Satan and his ability to transform into these apparitions. Carlo Ginzburg's detailed study of 16th century inquisitional records from northern Italy reveals how the authorities resolutely ignored statements of the locals that they fought demons in the spirit, while their bodies were at home asleep. Under duress, the accused changed their stories and confessed that they had consorted with demons for real. Several of the major witchcraft manuals at this time carefully considered the question of whether accused witches could be viewed as just having dreamt of the events that they described, or whether they should be prosecuted for actually having committed them. It could be argued that these developments constitute a transformation of the earlier phase of ascetic Christianity. The dream thoughts that the early medieval monks and clerics tried to repress, they then projected onto the unwitting public in the late medieval period. In place of lascivious thoughts unwillingly entertained in the monastic cell, the stories of accused witches involved soul travel out into the forests and fields, and wild, sometimes incestuous orgies with minions of Satan. Judges showed a particular interest in whether the intercourse with the devil was voluntary or forced, frightening or pleasurable. The belief in witchcraft eventually passed as the Age of Reason gained ground in Europe. After a series of dream visions in the early 17th century, Descartes resolved to pursue a career in philosophy and produced his crucial distinction between fantasy and reality. People began to rigorously explain dream phenomena in terms of natural physical causes and effects. Such physical explanations for erotic dreams had been groped for by the ancients, as we have seen, and these ancient sources were returned to and elaborated. between 1650 and 1850, no fewer than 25 tracts were written about the nightmare, often in Latin with titles like De Incubo. Both the erotic dream and the nightmare ultimately were tamed by such physical and medical explanations. But this could not change the fact that the two had been powerfully conjoined, for a long time, and they remained so connected even in a new scientific context that viewed them with dispassionate interest. An example would be the German physician Börner, who studied the classic nightmare in the 1850s, and he concluded that the sensations of dyspnea and paralysis arose directly from a difficulty of breathing and sleep caused by blockage or respiratory irritation, and that these called up the image of a shaggy animal, like Pan, who lay on the chest of the dreamer. Börner also added, and I quote, "Occasionally, and more commonly in women, the feeling of anxiety is coupled with that of lust, and women often believe that the phantom has had sexual intercourse with them. Men have analogous sensations, and generally emission of semen resulting from the pressure exerted on the genitalia by lying on the abdomen." Clinical medicine thus documented the erotic dream-nightmare connection. This is where our story began. These medical studies conditioned learned thought in the time of Roscher, Freud, Jones, and Malinowski. What has become of the matter today? To answer this, I must take one brief step backward before going forward. At the moment when science and philosophy had almost completely subdued the nightmare, the Romantics revitalized it in a sort of backlash against the tyranny of reason. On holiday in Switzerland, a select company that included Lord Byron, his personal physician John Polidori, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and his partner Mary Wollstonecraft regularly gathered around the fireplace. They were terribly bored by being confined by unseasonably cold weather and perpetual rainstorms, and so they amused themselves by reading aloud from a volume of German folktales. Then they turned their energies to composing their own horror stories. Polidori's idea for his short story, The Vampire, and Wollstonecraft's for Frankenstein, both arose at these gatherings and were published some years later. According to Christopher Frayling, who has written an illuminating study of the birth of horror, Wollstonecraft, only 18 years old at the time, could not think up an idea until one night she had a nightmare that involved bringing a dead person to life with a kiss. Polidori's vampire eventually became more famous in Bram Stoker's 1897 Dracula, and Frayling contends, on the basis of Stoker's diaries, that the idea for the novel came from a nightmare he had in 1890 in which a girl tried to kiss him, not on the lips, but on the neck. The familiarity of these stories today attests to the continuing power of this particular strand of the erotic nightmare. In the domain of medicine and psychiatry, on the other hand, the late 20th century nightmare seems to have entirely lost its erotic content. On the basis of a substantial collection of data in the Boston area, the psychiatrist Hartman did not detect any sexual content in his subjects' nightmares. He also noted that the nightmares were distributed fairly equally in number between men and women. I myself tried a computer search of all post-1970s psychology journals, entering the words nightmare, erotic, and sex, and only turned up a handful of articles studying sex-linked differences in nightmares. The situation seems to correlate with my students' experience. Nightmares are no longer erotic, and erotic dreams aren't nightmarish anymore. Get that in focus. Perhaps we're looking in the wrong place. Consider the burgeoning number of reports of encounters with aliens. Many think this just involves accounts of people who periodically mistake airplanes for UFOs. But in the last decade, there have been increasing numbers convinced that not only have they seen spaceships, but they've entered them and had quasi-sexual experiences with aliens. The first abduction story, and a good example of this genre, involved a couple named Barney and Betty Hill and occurred in 1965. My slide here is from the New York Times 1997 Fall Fashion Supplement special feature on emotions in fashion. It's about reclaiming women's irrational emotional motivations for selecting clothing. Back to the Hills story. They were abducted into a UFO while driving at night. Then they were separated into two rooms. The beings inserted a needle into Betty's abdomen and told her they were conducting a pregnancy test. A sperm sample was extracted from Barney. Many similar abductions have since been reported, and they often begin with the victims when the victim is in bed, perhaps asleep. Numerous abductees believe that they might be dreaming the events, or that they occur in an intermediate period between intermediate phase between fantasy and reality. Interestingly, the researchers who study them often discount these opinions and treat the events as real. These abduction accounts are very various, but they frequently involve a feeling of dread, terror, and paralysis. One is a captive and cannot just leave, and they often see themselves strapped down for the medical procedures. These invasions of one's reproductive system are frequently accompanied by mixed feelings of pleasure and horror. Women, who constitute the majority of abductees, report that the aliens perform something called mind scan on them, and this causes feelings of love for the aliens and the wish to submit to them. Sometimes the aliens even induce rapid sexual arousal, even orgasm, although victims report this as an unpleasant experience. The various accounts suggest that the aliens are conducting a sort of breeding program, taking human eggs and sperm with the intention of creating a hybrid offspring. Some abductees report seeing rooms filled with incubators containing fetuses. After reading these accounts, I realized that films like the Alien series are not purely the product of screenwriters' fantasies, but closely based on widespread popular experience. I go now to my conclusion. Accounts of intercourse between mortal women and angels is mentioned in Genesis chapter 6, subsequently adduced in discussions by early church fathers, and then later by the writers of witchcraft manuals. Alien abduction stories fit within this long history. How can we understand the retention of this theme and its perennial association with dreadful erotic paralysis? I turn to medical anthropology for some possible guidance. Among the Eskimos of Alaska, there are reports of a dream experience called Ukmerinek among the locals. People who have suffered from this report report that their soul departs from their body at the moment of falling asleep, and that it floats up to the ceiling of the room. They then experience a feeling of paralysis and an overwhelming anxiety that the soul cannot come back and reunite with their body. And on the opposite side of the North American continent, among descendants of British settlers in Newfoundland, there are reports of a sleep phenomenon known as the old hag. Old hag experiences involve feeling that a spirit comes to sleepers and presses on their chest, causing terror and asphyxiation. This is accompanied by a paralysis that prevents any action other than possibly crying out. Note that neither of these variants of sleep paralysis contains an erotic component. These phenomena have been labeled culture-bound syndromes by medical anthropologists, thereby implying that these syndromes exist uniquely within particular societies. The idea of culture-bound syndromes has been widely criticized as exoticizing and for obscuring the fact that all illnesses are inevitably culture-bound. We can, however, take the idea of culture-bound syndromes as an instructive mistake that helps us to appreciate Eskimo sleep paralysis and the old hag as simply two cultural variations of an experience that anyone could have, namely sleep paralysis. Sleep paralysis is a well-known, if somewhat rare, feature of non-REM sleep occurring near the onset or at the end of sleep. The examples of the nightmare and the erotic nightmare that I've examined may also be understood as the changing formulations and elaborations of sleep paralysis in the West. Once a conceptual category like this is created, like incubus, this quite possibly exercises a standardizing effect on disparate experiences. Indeed, it may even increase their frequency. All of the examples of what used to be classed as culture-bound symptoms were clearly denominated. They had a clear name at the local level. Erotic dreams constitute an even more common physical phenomenon, which again can receive any number of elaborations, as my history of mainly negative and problematic constructions reveals. Of course, it does not have to be this way. Patricia Garfield, author of a book called Creative Dreaming, reported that about 2/3 of her lucid dreams had sexual content, and about half culminated in orgasm. The message, I think, is that you can do it too. A good example of the unproblematic cultivation of erotic dreams is the manufacture and use of statues representing otherworld mates by the Baolei of Côte d'Ivoire. Both men and women can commission the carving of these small statues, and an appointed night of the week is set aside when one sleeps alone in order to have dream encounters, including erotic experiences, with these idealized otherworld beings. There's the male, and there's the female. As you can see, the bodies of the females are accentuated, while the clothing, indicating status, of the male statues is more emphasized. This reveals the features thought to be most appealing to male and female fantasies. These dream experiences with other world mates apparently serve as a complement to, and at the same time as a release from, one's real-life partner and the normal social world. This example points to the continuum between dream and fantasy, and to both of them as a mode or a dimension of everyday life in the world. The apparent ready suitability of the term repression to characterize anything to do with erotic dreams, thoughts, or impulses can sometimes cause us to miss this dimension. Attention to the opinions of ancient philosophers and doctors, Christian ascetics, witch hunters, should help us, the attention we've given them, should help us to realize that Freudian repression is but a recent conception of how erotic thoughts are internalized. It is not a privileged model for deciding and analyzing the issue for all time. Since Plato, Western society has been trying to eliminate the erotic nightmare, but it keeps coming back to haunt us. Like Malinowski, I think that psychoanalysis can often serve as an inspiration for anthropology, but it also requires dialogue and modification by anthropological insights. Erotic dreams and nightmares have been conceived very differently in European history, as well as in other cultures, and the erotic nightmare has slipped in and out of the historical record. This hybrid phenomenon has constantly shape-shifted and migrated genres from individual dream experiences to witchcraft accusations to cinema versions and to the lore of alien abductions. This historical anthropological account alerts us that it currently exists, as it always has, in complex tension between individual experience and elaborated cultural forms. Thank you.
On behalf of all of you, I'd like to thank Charles Stewart for a fascinating lecture, the display of his learning, and I'm sure that we'll all have very much more interesting nightmares for the next few days. I'd also like to invite all of you to join the speaker and members of the department for drinks on the fifth floor in the senior common room. Thank you, Charles.